I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie presented his $33.8 billion budget proposal yesterday afternoon, focusing largely on pension funding for state employees and announcing an agreement with the state teachers union. He also pushed back against state Superior Court Judge Mary Jacobson, who ruled on Monday that Christie had broken the law when he didn't make a full payment to New Jersey's pension fund for state employees. Christie said yesterday, "We don't need any court to tell us we have a serious problem." Governor Christie's popularity in New Jersey has taken a nosedive in recent months, with residents telling the Monmouth poll that they believe he's more interested in his own political future than the state's. And now there are reports that potential donors to his possible presidential campaign are eyeing Jeb Bush instead. Let me introduce our two guests. Kate Zernike is national correspondent for The New York Times, joins us from the studios of The New York Times. And Kate, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
And also with us is Charles Style. He's political columnist for The Record. He writes the Political Style column and contributes to NorthJersey.com. And Charlie Style, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
Let me begin with you, Kate, if I could. Does the governor have a signed agreement with the New Jersey Education Association?
He has a signed agreement on what they're calling the roadmap, which was actually a term that the teachers union came up with. But it's a very, I think what the teachers union was put off by yesterday and felt, frankly, a little bit used by was that the governor was presenting this as, I've reached across the aisle, we've got this bipartisan agreement, we are going to fix this together, we are going to, as he said, solve this problem. The teachers union said, no, in fact, all that we've agreed to is that we have a problem and that we need to keep talking. They've agreed to some basic principles, such as they agree that the union should manage its own pension fund. They've agreed that there need to be some benefit changes, but they don't agree that it should all come from them. What they're concerned about is that the governor is once again seeking benefit cuts from the teachers union and promising to pay, but that he will not actually promising that the state will make its pension obligations, but that it actually won't.
Charlie, are you surprised that the pension took up so much of Christie's speech last night or yesterday afternoon?
Not entirely. I am surprised that he didn't even offer a glancing mention about the Transportation Trust Fund, which is really a big issue right now. It's a bankrupt fund that the state uses to pay for repairing roads and bridges, and it's depleted, and there's been a lot of attention devoted to that in the state. So, and it's a thorny issue because at heart of that, of all the various solutions is a possible hike in the gas tax. So to not even mention it was kind of surprising. And it also indicates just an indication of how far off they are. And that their resolution to that problem is going to be elusive at this point.
But Charlie,
I was surprised that they didn't mention that, but not entirely. You know, the pension thing has been looming as a big ticket item on the horizon.
Indeed, and many states are dealing with that. But Charlie, is it because it has the word tax in it that's just anathema to Governor Christie, as it is to a lot of other governors?
Oh, I think so, especially a Republican governor who is about to jump on the 2016 campaign trail and trying to prove to particularly conservative activists that he's the real deal, that he can be trusted to carry the conservative mantle. But it's not just conservative. It's more the establishment corporate donors who want to make sure that they got their kind of person in the White House, somebody who is won't raise taxes and won't burden them or turn to them as a source of balancing the federal budget. So he can't touch it. I still think that is the prime directive that he's working for in his administration.
And we will get to that. Kate, let me go back to you, and even going back to Monday when this judge issued a ruling basically saying that Chris Christie had broken the law when the state didn't pay its, I guess, fair share into the pension fund. Take that apart for us and put it back together. This is a pretty bold move, it seems, on the judge's part.
Well, so we should probably establish what happened and what the law said. So in 2010, 2011, Governor Christie and the Democrats in the legislature signed pretty historic agreements saying that they were going to fix this pension problem. In fact, Christie went before the Republican National Convention in 2012 and said he had fixed the problem. And the way they had fixed it was twofold. What the Democrats and the teachers unions offered was that they would cut their benefits. The teachers would pay more into the pension fund. They would pay more toward their health costs. And in return, the state would promise to make its pension obligations. Governors, Republican and Democrat, have been skipping these pension payments for years and years. Christie said, we're going to make these payments. We're going to pay our obligations. We're going to do it slowly. We're going to pay. We're going to increase it by 1/7 over 7 years so that by 2018, we will be paying our fair share. What happened was Christie's budget, the governor has to have, by the state constitution, has to have a balanced budget. Christie could not balance his budget last year because revenues, the New Jersey economy has not rebounded the way other states have. So the budget was unbalanced. Christie said, the way I'm going to balance my budget is I'm going to cut these pension payments. I'm not going to make them. So he did that in 2014 and 2015. And now he's saying he wants to do that in 2016. Mm. The union sued, which was their right under the law. And the judge said in 2014, look, there's only 5 days left in this budget season, 5 days left to budget balance this budget. So Governor Christie, we're going to give you a pass for 2014. You don't have to make the payments. But she did find then in 2014 that the unions had a constitutionally protected contractual right to these to the state to make these payments. So what she said in Monday was that for 2015, the governor had to make these payments. The Democrats, the legislature presented him with a budget that made these payments, that did make it by raising a millionaire's tax for 3 years and a corporate tax for 1 year. But the Democrats, the legislature had found a way to pay for these pension payments. The governor used his line item veto to strike those payments out. And so what she said was the governor should not have done that. The governor does not get a pass this time. He needs to make these payments. The governor himself, in turn, said, I'm appealing this decision. And he really gave it, really only glancing mention in yesterday's speech.
But it would be coming up with, what, something like $2 billion in order to meet the obligations for this year, almost $3 billion.
Yeah. So what she said was that for 2015, which is the fiscal year we are in now, which ends in June, the governor skipped out on $1.57 billion. So she said he had to find that. Inherent in that decision is that the state has to make these payments. So the payment for this year is supposed to be $2.9 million. Oh. Christie has said he's going to pay about $2.9 billion, excuse me. Christie has said he's going to pay about $1.3 billion. So again, he's trying once again. He's going before the legislature yesterday saying, I'm going to make these payments. Trust me, we're going to get this pension problem fixed. But he's also saying, oh, but that agreement we had before, I'm not going to meet my obligation on that either for this year.
So how does someone, Charlie, find $1.5 or $2 billion in New Jersey?
Well, that is a big question right now. I mean, and the Democrat solution has been to raise the millionaire tax on millionaires or the affluent, and raising, as Kate mentioned, raising the taxes on corporations. And there are other, I guess you could, there are other efficiencies and potential cuts, but it really is, I think there is a growing realization that reaching that $3 billion tab, and then it's going to escalate, is just not doable. Mm. And I think that is one of the reasons why the NJEA quietly slipped in the back door of the Pension Reform Commission and started talking, because I think inherent in their decision to talk to the administration or through their intermediaries is a realization that the money is not coming, and that they're going to be facing a brick wall and potential maybe even more draconian solutions in the future. So they seem to be saying, look, we need to cut our losses now and maybe get a better deal if we go in and talk now. And that better deal means guaranteed funding, a constitutional guarantee for funding, and some control over a new pension system. So it's a very good question. I think the answer to that is no one really is. There is no clear path to $3 to $5 billion to pay for that fund right now. I mean, they're only estimating revenue growth of about $1.3 billion, I think, or 3.8% growth in revenues this year, which is very modest. And that's to cover the entire, a whole range of costs for the budget. So not and not just the pension fund. So that problem is just the gap is going to get wider and the bill is going to get wider.
Well, let me just add something else to this. And this is something obviously the governor and the state has to deal with, Kate, which is the rating agencies over the last couple of years have lowered the credit rating for New Jersey. We know about a number of the problems that Atlantic City has been having, losing casinos. And the fact that you mentioned earlier, Kate, is that New Jersey has lagged behind other states, including, I believe, this one, when it comes to job creation.
Right, that's absolutely true. But it's interesting to me that that the governor, not interesting, actually probably predictable, that the governor focused his pretty short, it was a shorter than usual budget speech, and he focused it exclusively on pensions, I think, because, and didn't talk about the Transportation Trust Fund, because the pensions is where he can get the political message out that he wants to get.
Right.
Chris Christie is struggling to regain his footing in the presidential campaign, with his presidential ambitions. And the way he can do that is to go back to the thing that made him famous across the country in the first place, was that he was the first of the Republican governors who said, I'm going to stand up to these greedy public employee unions. We are going to fix this problem. This is a problem that bedevils states, municipal governments across the country. I am going to fix this problem. And so what he can do, even if he doesn't actually have a plan or a solution to this, and frankly, the plan that he presented yesterday had some concrete steps, but had a lot more questions than it did have details. But he can go out and say, once again, you know, he can blame the unions for the budget problems. He can say, I'm giving you the honest truth. I am the guy who's going to give it to you straight. I'm a truth teller, which is all things he said yesterday and all things that we can expect to see him say in his town hall meeting today. And as he goes on the presidential campaign trail, he didn't bring up the Transportation Trust Fund because that doesn't offer him the opportunity for political rhetoric. And frankly, the solution there is even harder than it is with the pension. With the pension, he can blame the teachers union. With the Transportation Trust Fund, really, one of the only things that he can do is you know, he's got to find revenue somewhere. He's got to raise the money. He's got to probably raise the gas tax.
And we're almost
one of the things he said in the speech, yeah. I will not willingly sit by and let this continue. I mean, you know, that if there wasn't a soundbite ready for a drafted for a YouTube video or a campaign slogan, I don't know what is. I mean, this kind of me against the Gordian knot of Trenton and special interests, and I'm going to fight it. And so it positions him as a, you know, as this warrior, but as Kate mentioned, I mean, you know, he hasn't, frankly, if you go back on the history she just mentioned, he has actually exacerbated the problem while he was in office by cutting the pension, by not delivering on the payment that he agreed to.
Well, and we're going to, we need to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about New Jersey's Governor Chris Christie. That's Charles Style, political columnist for the Record. He writes the Political Style column and contributes to NorthJersey.com. Also with us is Kate Zernike, national correspondent for the New York Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Kate Zernike and Charlie Style about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Kate, do you think Governor Chris Christie's presidential aspirations, whatever they are, has hurt him in New Jersey? When you look at the polls, I mean, he got reelected, so clearly he had a majority when it came time for reelection, but he is not enjoying a majority today. What has happened?
Right. So as you said, and this is what his political advisors will say, is that really the only poll that matters is the ballot box. And at the ballot box in 2013, he beat his opponent by 22 points. So that's a huge, huge margin. But polls then, you know, a recent, I believe it was the Rutgers poll, showed him at the lowest level approval, the lowest level of his tenure. The polls ask things like, what do you think of what the governor's done on pensions? What do you think about the governor's travel across the country? Do you think the governor's paying too much attention? Or do you think he's more more concerned with his national aspirations or the state of New Jersey. People are consistently saying now over a period of months, starting in September, they're saying he's more interested in his presidential aspirations than he is in taking care of New Jersey's problems. They don't like what he's done on pensions. And I do think that, well, what, this is what the pollsters would say anyway, is that they started to see a change when they started to see a change in the beginning, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, when Chris Christie was first talked about as a presidential candidate, the polls all showed that people liked that. They thought, hey, we have this governor. He's famous. It's a nice thing. We, you know, they supported him. They didn't mind that he was doing this. The change has been now they think that he's paying too much attention to his presidential aspirations and not spending enough time on New Jersey's problems. And that's when his overall poll numbers, his approval ratings started to go down. So I definitely think that it is hurting him in New Jersey. He may not care about that. He may think, you know, I was never going to take New Jersey anyway. The difficulty is that Chris Christie pitched himself as the kind of Republican who could win with unusual alliances. He could win among women. He could win among Hispanics. He could win in a blue state like New Jersey. So to take away his New Jersey story actually hurts him. I mean, there aren't many governors who are so associated with their state as is Chris Christie. You know, maybe Scott Walker. I mean, you know, Jerry Brown, California. But I don't know that anybody really thinks of Scott Walker as particularly Wisconsinite. But certainly Chris Christie was a Jersey guy.
Well, Charlie, you have followed or have been with the governor when he's been in other states and talking, I guess, in sort of code language about running for the White House. What do you see when you see him outside of the state?
I think he portrays himself mostly as a, well, first of all, he tries to emphasize that he's a genuine conservative and that he can be trusted as a conservative, especially in Iowa. He made that speech at the summit, the Freedom Summit, about a month ago. He's also doesn't lean so much to the right, away from his more of his centrist identity as well. And he boldly in that appearance tried to make the case that he was conservative, but also said, look, we can't agree on everything, and we can't impose ideological litmus tests on candidates, or we're going to lose. So he was trying to balance this case of being a conservative that can be trusted, but also making the electable argument, and of course throwing in a whole litany of sound bites about his record here in New Jersey. You know, mostly a couple bullet points to remind people that he had amassed a record of an improbable record of reform here in New Jersey. And it's a record, frankly, that can be aggressively questioned. But out on the stump, that's how he basically portrays himself.
Kate, I'm looking at an article that you co-authored a couple of weeks ago. Headline, Chris Christie shows fondness for luxury benefits when others pay the bill. It was about a trip to Israel and Jordan, paid for in part by the King of Jordan. There was also a private plane that he took, the plane owned by Sheldon Adelson, the well-known billionaire casino owner. How much, first of all, I remember reading that in the beginning of February when it was first published, and I'm looking at it now. How much do you think articles like this are hurting him?
You know, I just think that I think what that article does is give people something, you know, sort of details that they can wave back at the governor, like a $30,000 hotel tab for a weekend picked up by the King of Jordan, you know, a free plane ride by this billionaire who is trying to, you know, lobby you against internet gambling. I don't know and this has been a pattern over Chris Christie's tenure. You know, when he was U.S. attorney, he was the Justice Department dinged him for staying at hotel rooms that were well above the government rate, for taking car services when he could have taken cabs or, you know, God forbid, a subway. I think the larger thing is just that Chris Christie has so, you know, he was so Teflon for so long. And I think now there's just so much to explain. And as someone said, a Republican said to me a couple weeks ago, when you're explaining, you're losing. And that's the problem for Chris Christie right now. He's just having to explain too much. And that article becomes yet again something he has to explain. And frankly, I think the pensions is something he has to explain. He has to explain why he stood up before the Republican National Convention in 2012 and said, I fixed this problem. And now he's saying, oh, wait, we're going to fix it. Wait, didn't you fix it before? So I just think, you know, I think the travel hurts him because it's something that it's kind of, you know, it's like the bridge closings. The bridge closings hurt him because it's easy to say, like, oh, he caused a traffic jam, or his aides caused a traffic jam, whatever happened. The hotel is kind of, you know, grabby in that way. It's a little harder to understand than pensions. But I think for the most part, it's just become kind of a pile up for him.
And speaking of bridge closures, Charlie, where do things stand with the Bridgegate scandal, such as it has been called?
Well, I think everybody's waiting for U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman to, reveal his findings of now it's almost 14 month investigation. And there's a lot of talk, a lot of chatter of potential indictments of former Christie aides. And so we're just going to, we're basically waiting on that. There's also been further evidence that this investigation has mushroomed beyond just the focus on the bridge, specifically on former Port Authority Chairman David Sampson and his business interests. And also, they've taken particular focus of negotiations that the Port Authority had with the United Airlines, and whether or not a special flight from Newark to South Carolina, reinstated in, I think it was 2012, a special flight that was reinstated to accommodate David Sampson, possibly accommodate his a weekend travel to his home in South Carolina. Wow. It was a flight that was routinely half empty, and they canceled it shortly after he resigned. So that portends to the possibility, opens the possibility of this case widening beyond just the bridge closing.
And that's Charles Style, political columnist for The Record. He writes the Political Style column and contributes to NorthJersey.com. Kate Zernike is with us as well, national correspondent for The New York Times. We are talking about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Yesterday, he delivered his budget proposal. As we all know, he does have presidential aspirations. We're not sure exactly how far they will go, but he's certainly a name that is bandied about. And there are some problems that he has at home. It looks like those popularity that he enjoyed has gone away, not entirely, but certainly is not what it used to be. We want to hear from you about what you think of Governor Chris Christie, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get, looks like Jose from Burlington County to join us. Jose, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Governor Christie, over the last 5 years, has promoted himself as being an overall cure-all. If you look at his policies, he does not believe in shared sacrifice. Look at the issue, the argument that's taken place with the millionaire's tax. He has displaced the working poor. He has created a position within the lieutenant governor's position and appointed her to the commissioner to the Department of State. Entrepreneur in bringing in business, it hasn't happened. If you look at his travel, he's written an executive order for himself, and he's the very first one to exercise that executive order, enabling him to be able to accept gifts from the outside. He's thrown the baby out with the dirty water, and anyone that could help him solve the problems for the state, he has displaced or polarized. He is a tremendous problem, and at the end of the day, the devil is in the detail, and the state of New Jersey will find out more and more about his going on. I do not.
Well, you know, Jose, hold on one. Let me just jump in here, and then it's clear you are a critic of Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, and clearly you are not alone. But Kate, is you know, when you hear Jose talk, does that sound like a familiar complaint against the governor?
Well, certainly it's a familiar complaint among his critics, and I think, you know, he's very. He's pretty polarizing, especially at this point. But again, what's interesting is that his selling point was that he wasn't polarizing, was that he could reach across the aisle, that he had this broad appeal, that he could win, that a Republican governor could win 61% of the vote in a blue state. So, yeah, I think a lot of those complaints are pretty familiar.
But is it, and I wonder, I don't want to, you know, put him on the psychiatrist couch or anything like that, but Charlie, I mean, is it also personality? And in many ways, he has touted the kind of Jersey personality that, that he has, but I wonder whether that has or is beginning to hurt him.
I think it is beginning to hurt him, because I think people were willing to give Christie a wide berth initially, that they were willing to look the other way and maybe avert their eyes or hold their nose as long as he was in the trenches engaged and working towards reforming New Jersey or fixing New Jersey. And now, because of his presidential travel, they see him as an absentee governor. So they're not so willing to put up with, you know, a lot of his antics and his brash style. They just see that as just, bad behavior, or I think they're just weary of it. They'll take it if there's results. But if you really go back on his record over the past 2 years, he hasn't been engaged. There isn't really one significant achievement he can point to.
And I think that's a really important point. And I think that's why he talks so much about pensions, because there's not really much else he can talk about.
Wow.
Right. And if you go back to his first term, there was a poll taken by Monmouth University that found that 9 out of 10 people they surveyed knew about the budget debate in Trenton. That was unheard of. The public was deeply engaged in first term Christie. Now it's vanished. He's vanished.
And vanished in part because, as you have written, Kate, when he was chairman of the Republican Governors Association, he spent 42% of his time outside of New Jersey. Now, obviously, there are responsibilities that go with that, but nonetheless, and for last year, he was out of the state 137 days, or about 40% of the time. I don't know how that compares to other governors, but that's a lot of time not in New Jersey.
It is a lot of time. And when I calculated those numbers in December, I think the second number, the 40% number you referred to, was the percentage of time he'd been out of the state since his second inauguration last January. Mm. In this January, he and February, Frank, I haven't looked at the days in February, but certainly in January, he was out of the state more than he was in it. Mm. So I'm thinking that number is probably that he's probably spent more than half of his first term out of the state at this point.
Is he running for president?
He's turned it into a part-time job.
But is he running for president?
The legislature.
Yes, I think he absolutely is.
He is running. Do you agree, Charlie, that he is running for president?
Oh, I think he's been running since June of 2010.
Okay. I was just checking.
Supreme Court justice. And
there is some
precedent in action. Yeah, I think he definitely has been planning from the moment he took office.
Go ahead, Kate.
Well, I was just going to say, I think there is some chatter that they're waiting to see what happens with the Bridgegate indictments and how badly that he gets hurt by that. But so that he's waiting until April for that point. If you remember last year, he said he would make a decision sometime early in the new year, particularly after Jeb Bush jumped in.
Right.
So everyone thought that it would be January. Now the Christie people are saying more like April. So I do think they, I guess they're giving themselves a little bit of wiggle room. But I think Charlie's right that he's been running since he came into office. And I certainly think that he's intending to run now.
Charlie, I want to quote something that you wrote. This is when Christie was in New Hampshire and, as you wrote, launched a blistering attack on New Hampshire's newly reelected Democratic governor, Maggie Hassan. He said she will use this platform to increase her visibility and try to run for the next job. Let's be careful. We've got enough of those types in Washington, D.C. already. We don't need you to send any more there. And as you wrote, a kind of ironic thing for Governor Christie to be saying, certainly criticizing another governor of another state.
Yeah, I think that goes back to the point that ignited a lot of discussion here in his home state about the sheer hypocrisy of him saying something like that, given that he's basically turned the governor's office into a full-time, marketing machine for his national image since he took the office here in 2010. But it goes back to the point that he's not concerning himself about the way he's viewed here in New Jersey, that he's moved on and he's got bigger fish to fry, and that New Jersey really doesn't fit into the pursuit of 270, I forget the number, for electoral votes. 274, is it 271? I can't remember that.
I can't either, but obviously a number of electoral votes and the key role that New Jersey plays. But Kate, and just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye to the two of you, then we have John Brabender who's going to be joining us. But, I mean, can he be so absent and still be governor of New Jersey? I mean, I realize he can be governor, but, you know, call himself governor?
Well, in fact, he can because he has been doing that. And what he and furthermore, he actually wants to go even farther and say that there's a requirement in New Jersey that when the governor leaves the state, he has to transfer powers to the lieutenant governor. Governor Christie is actually saying and got a Republican to propose legislation like this. I believe it's a constitutional amendment that would say that in this age of cell phones and email, that when the governor leaves the state, he doesn't have to transfer his powers to the lieutenant governor. So Chris Christie actually believes he can be governor. He believes he can be governor when he's in New Jersey on the rare occasion, and he believes he can be governor when he's in Iowa or Ohio or Pennsylvania or wherever he is trying to get votes for the presidential race.
Do you think, Charlie, that his record in New Jersey, though, will be a factor if he does run for president?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that has been his whole calling card. That has been, that I was a Republican conservative in a blue state bastion were able to, as Kate called it, unusual alliances, forge unusual alliances and get things done. And I think the record in New Jersey is going to come under a harsh microscope. And pension reform will be at the top of the list.
Does that mean that he will try to get something done on this?
Oh, I think he'll feel pressure on it. And I think that's why he's eager to co-opt the NJEA, because they have enormous influence in the legislature, particularly with the Democrats. And if the NJEA says, hey, you know, this is a go and we want this, then it's going to be very hard for the Democratic leadership to tell him no, especially the Senate President, Steve Sweeney, who wants to run for governor in 2017 on the Democratic ticket. He's not going to tell the NJEA no if they want this or some version of whatever comes out of negotiations, if they even get that far.
NJEA, the New Jersey Education Association. Charlie Style, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're more than welcome.
Political columnist for the record. Kate Czernicki, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. National correspondent for the New York Times. And yes, we have John Brabender waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we've been talking about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, some of the challenges that he is facing at home and some of the challenges that face him on the national stage as he eyes the White House. We asked John Brabender to join us. He's the chief creative officer of Brabender Cox. That's a Republican consulting firm. His clients have included Rick Santorum, Tom Coburn, and Rudy Giuliani. John Brabender, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So how do you see Christie's star either rising or falling on the national stage as a presidential contender?
Well, the one thing we've learned in the last two Republican primaries for the presidency is that stars rise and fall very quickly, and you can have second comings as well. And so people do have to be a little bit careful not to start to write that one candidate or the other is sort of the front runner and the other one is out of the race. We find there's great fluidity in races like this. And to me, that's not the real challenge for Chris Christie right now. I think the real challenge, if I look at it, is that in a Republican primary, there's these different sort of buckets of voters. If you went down the list, you have the establishment bucket, you have the Tea Party, social conservatives, libertarians, what I'll call working Republicans, and then foreign policy and fighting terrorism. And probably the biggest challenge for Chris Christie is that the bucket that he always wanted to own was sort of going to be the establishment inevitable candidate. You know, he was going to make the argument that he was the best November candidate against Hillary Clinton. He served as head of the Republican Governors Association, where, you know, he had a successful year there and was going to get all those governors behind him and all this. Jeb Bush has sort of changed all that because Jeb Bush is going to own that establishment bucket probably a lot better than Chris Christie is going to. So they're forcing Chris Christie to find other places to find votes in a Republican primary. And it's going to be a challenge for him because there are those other buckets are pretty full right now. So that's going to be the biggest challenge, in my opinion, at least.
Let me ask you, I was just talking with Kate Zernike and Charlie Style. They both cover New Jersey politics and Christie for their respective newspapers. And we were talking about some of the problems and challenges, frankly, that Christie is facing in his own state and the fact that his popularity has fallen off. As a national candidate, and I know we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves here, but I'm just curious, does it matter for someone who's a governor what's happening in their state when it comes to running for, let's say, the White House?
Well, I think it depends on the state. I mean, you know, quite honestly, New Jersey is one of those states that in presidential politics is not at the top of the list for Republican targets. And maybe the best example I can give you is a Rick Santorum, who in Pennsylvania lost his last election in 2006, yet went on in 2012 to win 11 out of the 30 presidential primaries. And so, you know, you don't have to just always have success in your home state. It depends on how red or blue that home state is. You know, I would probably argue that the most important state in the nation right now to Chris Christie is going to be New Hampshire, because it's a better state for him probably than Iowa. You know, there's going to be a lot of people who I think are going to come in Iowa and probably be ahead of him moving into New Hampshire. The state after that is going to be South Carolina, which probably is not going to be the greatest state for Chris Christie, I would guess. So very early on in a presidential race, you have to show some credibility by coming in first or second. And to me, for Chris Christie, that probably is going to have to be New Hampshire.
What do you make of his personality? And I mean, he has very much touted his kind of brash personality. He is someone that follows him around and shows him, you know, arguing with people that ask him critical questions. As a consultant, does that play well, do you think, nationally?
Well, first of all, the consultant, what I always say is the candidate is the candidate. And the biggest mistake you can ever make is to try to give them something that's not authentic for them. So I think there is sort of this authentic nature to Chris Christie. I think that people actually do respect that he speaks his mind. And you know, to some degree, I think he has to position himself as sort of this American original. I think he needs to go to places like Iowa, New Hampshire, and places like that and say, look, you're always going to know where I stand. You're always going to have honesty for me and candor, and that's who I am, and that's what we need more as a president and everything else. And I think that's something people will appreciate. They're going to look for results to go with it, and that you're not just confrontational. But I think that actually the biggest mistake, I know that there was some talk that should we go with a quieter, nicer, you know, sort of Chris Christie that maybe will play in the heartland of America. That's not Chris Christie, and those people will be able to see the fact that the authenticity is gone, and that would actually be, I think, detrimental to him. But as you see, there are styles, particularly on the East Coast, that's different than other parts of the regions. I mean, you know, you look, Rudy Giuliani's temperament, it was very similar to Chris Christie's. I mean, he would get in arguments with reporters, he would get in arguments with others, but he was always sort of authentic, and people respected that. And I would argue that when Ed Rendell was mayor of Philadelphia, he had somewhat of a similar approach as well, that, you know, he would, you know, be always honest and open and say exactly what he was thinking at the time, and it wasn't necessarily just couched in talking points that were handed to him 30 seconds earlier. And so I do think the key is to turn that into a positive, and to me the positive is that somebody can trust you because you aren't just speaking off a teleprompter, that you are seeing what you truly believe. And so I think there are some advantages if you work at that properly.
And I do want to talk to you about Rudy Giuliani and some things that he said about President Obama. But let me ask you also about the reports that a number of the donors are now beginning to look at Jeb Bush and turning away from Chris Christie. And the New York Times reported on this, a report on a number of complaints about Christie. And I'll just read some of them. He does not return phone calls. He doesn't ask for support. He arrives late for meetings. He acts as if he has all the time in the world. Friends say Mr. Christie is both understaffed and too controlling, and on and on and on it goes from there. Some supporters are critical of the governor's campaign. They blame what they call Christie's bubble, a tight-knit circle of advisors who have known him for years. Do you see this as a problem for the governor?
Look, every campaign has to run in an organized and well thought out manner. Now, I do know the people who are very much running, you know, Chris Christie's campaign, and these are some of the best professionals in the country, quite frankly. And so, you know, my guess is probably managing Chris Christie the person is different, you know, than a lot of other candidates. There are a lot of candidates that just want to be told where to go, what to say, and when to do it. I think we probably all could agree that Chris Christie is not one of those candidates. I think probably, though, it's in his best interest to understand that donors, particularly large donors this cycle, have probably 12 different credible candidates out there to choose from. And so the competition is great for those candidates. And, you know, that means they're looking for a lot of respect from people who are asking them to help them. And the type of respect includes making sure that you're there on time, you know, making sure you're prepared and so forth. And so I would imagine that probably a style that worked well for Chris Christie as governor, because you can get away with that on the national level. I do think probably Chris Christie has to understand the importance of some of those things. I doubt it's the people around him, because I know them well enough that I know they know it.
Well, that's interesting. It's also interesting that Scott Walker, another governor, different state, obviously, it looks like his star, as you say, you know, things come and go, but that his star is a bit on the rise. Do you think that explains Christie's slightly small a falling star today?
Well, certainly, yeah, there's always going to be the candidate du jour, if you will. And, you know, Chris Christie might have been that, I think, last fall to some extent. But I think we're going to see a change constantly. I mean, you got to understand, too, the one other advantage Chris Christie has is he has been pretty much scrutinized and vetted. And what you have with Chris Christie, you know, there's going to be a lot of new candidates who are going to come and rise, who truly probably haven't been vetted, haven't gone through the same process Chris Christie has, and so forth. And so, you know, one thing that we'll find is some of them will pass that test and some of them won't. I mean, we saw that in 2012 was a good example. You know, you had at one point Herman Cain leading the pack. You had Newt Gingrich leading the pack. You had Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry. All took turns that were leading. And then they either didn't even make it to Iowa, or in Michelle Bachmann's case, she won the Ames straw poll but came in last in Iowa. And so, you know, there's such fluidity.
Seems like we have lost our guest. Let's see if we can get him up on the phone. And again, talking with John Brabender. He's the chief creative officer for Brabender Cox. That's a Republican consulting firm. His clients have included Rick Santorum, Tom Coburn, and Rudy Giuliani. As I mentioned, I do want to talk with John Brabender about some of the comments of Rudy Giuliani. Looks like we have him back, John. I'm not sure what happened, but we lost you.
Well, I don't either. And I said, while I was gone, I think I said some really brilliant things.
Well, we'll have to go back to the tape and figure out what that is. I have a couple
more. You have a tape? Never mind.
I'm just pulling your leg there. Let me ask you, because it looks like, you know, people are scratching their head about Hillary Rodham Clinton. Will she run? Will she not run? It sort of looks like she will run and that she'll have almost no challengers. Why do so many Republicans want to be president of the United States?
Well, I think that a lot of people make it their goal in life to become president of the United States. But I think that to truly run, they have to have it in their heart that they believe that they are the right one to run this. I mean, this is not something – I mean, most of these candidates won't even understand until about a year from now the difficulty of running, the schedule that you have to keep and so forth. Last time there were 22 debates. Now, this time I think it'll be closer to 12 or 14, which is a more reasonable number. But those can be grueling. You know, the first one is set for August in Cleveland. And so, you know, I also think that a lot of Republicans feel that, you know, Hillary is vulnerable. I don't, you know, I know I see a lot of respect from my Democrat friends who often say, oh, you have nobody that could beat Hillary Clinton. And I think that the one thing they forget is Hillary has a pretty long record that will be analyzed in great detail, and that there are a lot of negative things in that. And I think things that will give people some pause. And so I think on the Republican side, you know, we're feeling pretty good about the team here, in a sense, of men and women who are seriously considering this. And you know, I think that that they all are hopeful that they will be the next president of the United States.
As I said, you worked with Rudy Giuliani, and it may not be fair to ask you this, but you know the man. He said recently, I do not believe, and I know this is a horrible thing to say, I do not believe that the president loves America, talking about President Obama. He wasn't brought up the way you were brought up, the way I was brought up, through love of this country. How do you understand what Rudy Giuliani is saying?
Well, I mean, look, first of all, I you know, I don't agree with the comments of the mayor. I mean, you know, I have great respect for the mayor in this case. I just don't agree with what he said. I think that the bigger problem is not what he said, but the net effect of what he said. And that was to change the dialogue from let's have a real discussion on how we're going to fight ISIS. And, you know, that this is all in the context of the president giving speeches on foreign policy and so forth. And so, you know, to me, we changed the debate from what the president said in his speech about not mentioning technically who our enemy is and what their background is to give them credibility. And I think that that's a mistake. And that's where the sort of conversation should be. Instead, Rudy's comments moved the conversation to what he said. And I think that's a shame, because I think we're at a critical point where there needs to be a national dialogue and discussion on how we are going to fight ISIS and how we are going to handle a fast-moving Iran towards nuclear capabilities and so forth. And as you see, all it takes is a comment by that, by someone who's not even in office at this point, who's not running for anything, but it dominates the news. Mm. And I think that's the real problem, is when that happens and distracts us and, frankly, distracts our party from the things that we need to be talking about.
But is that what he wanted, do you think, to be in the news? Because he certainly has put himself in the news. I mean, that was an insulting, personal, and frankly, wrong thing that he said. He said, all I can see from this president, all I've heard from him, is he apologizes for America. He criticizes America. All you have to do is go to the tape to find plenty of examples of the president praising this country.
Yeah, look, if I understood the context right, Rudy Giuliani said this what was not on an, you know, open press sort of situation. And I think that a lot of us probably speak with candor, not to get attention sometimes, but candor among people that are in a private manner that we would never speak in a much more, you know, sort of formalized one. So I don't think his motivation was sort of, oh, I'm going to make some news tonight. I know Rudy well enough that, just like a Chris Christie, Rudy says what's in his heart and what he believes. Mm. And I think, you know, the statements that he said after word is that, you know, he sort of doubled down on it. He said, I said what I meant to say. And so that's Rudy's prerogative and so forth. Again, as a strategist who works with Republican candidates, my bigger concern is that's great, but right, it's a distraction at this point. And I don't think that that's helpful.
So he believes that the president doesn't love the country.
I'm sorry, what?
So Rudy Giuliani believes the president doesn't love his country?
I think that's, you know, the statement that he made, and he stood by that statement. And I don't know which parts he was standing by, if it was all there or so forth. That's, you know, that's up to Rudy Giuliani to defend. But like I said, my bigger problem was not Rudy being Rudy and speaking whatever is on his mind. My bigger problem is, you know, just the fact that we're having a discussion on this is taking us away from the bigger topic, which I think is you know, sort of the concern that this president is taking the wrong approach to fighting what is a legitimate threat with ISIS.
John Brabender, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we will be calling you back over the next year or so as this presidential race begins to take shape. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, and take care.
You too. And he's the chief creative officer of Brabender Cox, and that's a Republican consulting firm. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.